Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, why many of us are so naturally inclined to want to defend forests and the questions raised and investigated by environmental philosophers. First, the weather. More to the point, weather forecasting, meteorology. Why it's critical to our well-being and what's been happening to weather forecasting on the national level. John Bobel takes up these questions with Joe Sullivan. Until his recent retirement and the wave of cutbacks to the National Weather Service, the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service station in Louisville.
Joe, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you, John.
You've been a meteorologist ever since you were 8 years old?
Not degreed since I was eight, but yeah, I started young. I used to get excited about the weather, and I remember climbing trees in the yard just trying to see tornadoes that were reported off in the distance and things like that.
So you continued that on and went to Iowa State University?
That's correct. I got my degree there and got into television for a year before I got into the National Weather Service.
When you were the warning coordination meteorologist, exactly what's your role and responsibility in the weather office?
Well, for most people, the WCM is the single point of contact in many offices that they have. We're the ones that work with the emergency managers at the local level, all the counties. Louisville had 49 counties in central Kentucky and 10 in southern Indiana. So we had a lot of different emergency managers that we needed to work with, and every single one of them had my phone number. And so if something happened at 2 or 3 in the morning and they wanted the office to know about it, they would frequently call me because even though I wasn't working that time of the day, they knew that they could get to somebody who would know what they were talking about and understood their area, and I could get the information. I was sort of a go-between between the forecasters whose primary job was to understand the weather and put out warnings based on the weather, and the people that were making the decisions on the ground, and I could help them make those decisions.
In Kentucky, there are three primary weather offices, and then weather offices that kind of cover bits and pieces of the state?
Correct. When they did the modernization back in the 1990s that you mentioned in the intro, we went from about 350 offices down to 120, got rid of the smaller offices that were staffed with perhaps anywhere from 3 to 7 people. And the other offices expanded upward and have a total staff usually of about 20 to 25 people. And when that happened, they realigned things based on the radar coverage because of telecommunications abilities at the time in the 1990s. It wasn't like you can just click on your phone now and see the radar in Albuquerque, New Mexico, or Tampa, Florida without any problem. So they based the what we call county warning areas on where the radars were located. So Wilmington, Ohio picked up 10 counties in northern and northeastern Kentucky. Charleston, West Virginia has 4 counties in the east, and the rest are divided between Louisville, Paducah, and Jackson.
But there are going to be times when if you're looking at a forecast further out, you're going to be concerned about Memphis and Nashville and Knoxville and some of the other forecast offices that may show weather that's coming this way.
Oh, exactly. It's always very fluid because weather doesn't know any boundaries. So you're always coordinating with those offices around you, and you're watching the weather farther away because as one forecaster at the Storm Prediction Center years ago used to say the SPC, the ones that put out the watches, they don't forecast on a postage stamp. Most forecast offices wait for the weather to come over their postage stamp and put out the warnings there. The SPC follows the weather across the United States. But even in the postage stamps, you can't look at just the weather that's happening within your boundary. You have to keep an eye on what's coming from the other offices. And that's where the Weather Service has really advanced throughout my career, was really the coordination between offices.
You touched on something that's important for people to realize. Weather warnings don't come out of the local forecast office. They come out of the Storm Prediction Center.
The watches come from the Storm Prediction Center, but they coordinate also with the local offices to decide, because you've got to draw a line somewhere. And whether you draw that line between Frankfurt and Lexington or between Frankfurt and Louisville makes a big difference, because people's lives are impacted when you put out a watch. You know, certain businesses have to do things different ways when they have a watch out. And with the local expertise that you have from the offices in Jackson and Louisville, they could decide where that line needs to be drawn. And that helps companies, you know, with their production line, if they have to bring on extra people or do some other preparation when a watch is in the area versus when one isn't.
There are a lot of specialized forecasts that weather forecast offices publish for very specific interest areas.
Oh, exactly. Even though the National Weather Service got rid of its true agricultural forecast years ago, back in the 1990s, they still produce the information. They just don't create the text for it. And a lot of places, including the UK Ag Weather Center, take that information on drying conditions and put it into a format that can be used by farmers for agricultural purposes. Airplanes don't fly unless the National Weather Service is putting out the forecast for the airports. I mean, they can fly, but they need to know what's going on. And while most airlines have their own forecast staffs now, some of those are even being sent out to other corporations, and they're not doing it on their own. But they all base their forecasts on the same models that the National Weather Service is producing and creating every day, as well as the input that the forecasters at the local offices have, because they know the local weather better than anyone else.
I've heard it said many times that one of the most important appliances in a home is a NOAA weather radio. How important is that weather radio in a home?
Oh, I think they're as important as a smoke alarm. You can't even buy a house without an active working smoke alarm now. The fire industry has done a much better job at promoting and marketing their effectiveness than the National Weather Service, to be quite honest. Because with a NOAA weather radio, it'll wake you up in the middle of the night. I consider it a smoke alarm for weather. In the years before we had the internet and everybody could look at a radar in their pocket, it was the only way that you were going to get informed at night if you were asleep. Now there's other ways to do it, but you still need something that's going to wake you up and alert you, and then you can grab your phone and see what's going on and get the additional detailed information. But if you don't have a weather radio and you're sleeping soundly, especially with the air conditioning on, and you don't hear thunder in the distance, it may be too late before you wake up.
And a lot of the weather radios also have features for people with disabilities. I've heard that some of them can activate a strobe light if people have a hearing impairment, or there are bed shakers that can rattle a bed if they have another type of disability, or if they're just heavy sleepers.
Right, exactly. You know, my youngest daughter sets the alarm and has 10 snoozes every day before she gets up. You know, some people just need to be slapped in the face to wake up, I swear. And she would be a good one to have the bed shaker, or the pillow shaker, and the strobe light in addition to the wailing alarm just to wake her up. And then there's other people who, sometimes forget about communities like the Amish and the Plains communities that don't have electrical or modern day conveniences. And most Amish communities are allowed to have a weather radio type thing in a central location, or as long as it's outside their home. And we've actually been working on a project that started after the Mayfield tornado, to try and bring weather radios to those communities. It's a project called Weather Awareness for a Rural Nation, because it's not just for the Amish or Plains communities. It's for people that don't have sirens. Sirens are great for waking you up if you've got your windows open and you're within 4 miles of one. But out in the rural communities, you can't reach people with sirens. Unless they put up a lot of sirens. And some counties have done that. Metcalfe County did that several years ago, where they didn't put up sirens. They found that it was too expensive to put up all the sirens. So what they did was they put up a weather radio repeater and bought weather radios for every building that they had in the county. And that was much more efficient cost-wise than putting up all the sirens.
One of the things that I've heard is coming, depending on budget and operational for National Weather Service, is that in some cases where counties are very large, the National Weather Service is going to be able to carve up the counties into different zones to where they can issue an alert for just part of a large county.
Yeah, they did some of that in the past, and then they got away from it, and now they're going back to it. It's one of those things that's a good idea that sometimes it's difficult to implement, but it doesn't stop being a good idea. And I think it basically was designed to be for a large county that maybe weather radio wouldn't serve the entire county, or it, because it was so large, it might be 40 or 50 miles between individuals in a county, and there's no danger for people in one warning, but there is for another, because we've advanced with technology. We've always issued warnings based on the storm, but saying where the storm was and where it was going, the only way it was efficient to do that in the past was to use county boundaries, because those were set in stone, so to speak. But not all storms follow county lines, you know that. And there are numerous cases where a storm goes across southern Fayette County and it doesn't affect the north. And it would be nice to be able to warn the folks in the southern part of the county without waking them up in the north. And by subdividing the FIPS code, that's the Federal Information Processing System county code, it's possible there's one digit that can make it up nine different things. So basically you do it like a tic-tac-toe box, and you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And then zero means the entire county. Now, in counties like Fayette, which is more of a wheel and spoke type design, you could set it up in a different way that might be going around the clock or something like that, but it would identify zones better. And that's already sort of being done in Madison County with the old Bluegrass Army Depot. They had their zones, and the emergency management did that for years. I would love to see that in Louisville and Lexington, primarily because the population density is so high that there's no reason for kids to go into the hallway and put their heads down and prepare for a tornado in the north part of a county when the storm is only affecting the southern half.
Joe, we've heard a lot about reductions in force at all sorts of federal government offices, including the National Weather Service. Some of those cuts have affected National Weather Service offices in Kentucky. How does that affect these offices?
Well, in a couple of ways. One is it's morale. When all of a sudden you're having to pull more shifts because there aren't as many people to cover the normal rotation. In fact, they had to shut down the Jackson office at night for about, I think, a 4 to 6 week period because they didn't have enough people to staff it. Now they're bringing people in temporary duty status to help fill out, and they're having other offices watch over them at night. But at four of the offices that serve Kentucky, four of the five offices, there's no official in charge anymore, no meteorologist in charge. I mean, there's someone that's in acting position at each one of them, but the person who's supposed to be there running the office, calling the shots, not necessarily working the shifts, is being filled in now by someone who does some of those other things. Usually the warning coordination meteorologist, like myself, who that takes away from their time to work with the emergency managers, or the science and operation officer is the other person typically filling in, and that's the person that oversees the science and technical operations of the office. So there's a level of frustration and fatigue that after so long can't help but be set in, especially if the weather's really active. We've been fortunate this year in that the weather has not been very active in the last couple of months. We're been fairly dry, so that helps out. And it's a blessing that we have some dry weather just to let everybody get some rest.
With the recent announcement that the National Weather Service was going to start hiring people again, how long does that process take? You just don't go onto the street corner with a sign saying, need a meteorologist now, let's talk.
Right. The spin-up time for a new hire is usually about 3 years. That's all the training that they have to go to. It used to be that it was in-person training in Norman, Oklahoma, or Kansas City, Missouri. Most of it now is done via the internet. But it's a very time-consuming thing. There's a lot of technicalities that you have to learn to do the job. And you just can't hire someone and expect them to be ready to work in 3 or 6 months. It just is impossible to do. And when you let people go when they're under a year in this service and hire someone to replace them, then you have to replicate all the training that that other person did that was maybe under a year in, just under a year in before they got let go.
In addition to those people who were downsized, there were a lot of people who retired, who were encouraged to retire, and that institutional knowledge is gone as well.
Oh, exactly. there were a lot of people that had 25 to 30 years of experience. I believe 650 people left the National Weather Service from one way or another, whether it was the fork in the road or one of the later VERAs or VISAs, the voluntary early separation or retirement. But there's absolutely no way to replace thousands of person years with new hires, because the institutional knowledge, the way the knowledge of the current weather situation today in this area versus what it was 10 years ago or 15 or 20 years ago, that's the sort of thing you can't train someone for. It's something that you can only live through and gain by doing it.
Joe Sullivan is a retired National Weather Service meteorologist, most recently working at the Weather Forecast Office in Louisville. Joe, thanks for joining us today on Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me.
For Eastern Standard, I'm John Bobel.
They call it stormy Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad.
A quick follow-up on our recent conversation with Jacob Ball, head of the Bluegrass Ag Tech Corporation, about this year's winners of challenge grants, which are meant to attract and grow ag tech and food-based businesses in the Commonwealth. And it gives you a good sense of the innovation going on around here. Canball Incorporated transforms a corn byproduct into compostable food containers. Orb Technologies produces a biocomposite block made from straw and grass to use in construction. And Santerre International has a process that converts invasive carp into fertilizers for organic farming. The three were selected to receive a combined total of $300,000 in grant funding. Coming up after the break, on behalf of the forest.
If we continue to take these forests for granted, we do so at risk of undermining our own well-being.
And the fundamental questions explored by environmental philosophy.
Are we part of the natural world? Are we distinct from the natural world?
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at weku.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. John Muir, also known as John of the Mountains and Father of the National Parks, was a Scottish-born American naturalist, author, environmental philosopher, botanist, zoologist, glaciologist, and early advocate for the preservation of wilderness. And as Muir put it, in every walk with nature, one receives far more than he seeks. Many Kentuckians know this. Hardwood forests cover 50% of Kentucky. There are more than 12 million forested acres in the state. Many of us almost literally grew up in the woods. Well, here for a conversation about our forests and our relationships with them is Dr. Catherine Newfont, Associate Professor of History at the University of Kentucky, with research interests in Appalachian history, the U.S. South, and environmental history. She also has an intimate relationship with forests. Let's start with that. Tell me about your experience with the forest.
Well, I grew up with forests as neighbors and friends and companions, basically. Our house backed up to the woods, and I ran around in those woods with my brothers and had a wonderful time and thought of them as playgrounds and adventure sites and actually kind of a little convenience store, too, because we would pick blueberries or crack hickory nuts, or we could always find a little something out there. If we got feeling peckish. So I have wonderful memories of that growing up. I'm really grateful that I got to have those experiences. And my understanding, Tom, is that you also have memories of that kind of time in the woods as a young person.
I do. And since we started talking about this, and I've been thinking about it, it stays with you for a lifetime. It really does. In my case, I grew up in Moorhead in Rowan County. And at that time, our house was a hop, skip, and a jump in either direction from the Daniel Boone National Forest. And as kids, from as early on as I can remember into my teens, that's where we were, all the way around the calendar. It was as fun to be up there in the winter, for some reason or another, as it was in the summer. But, you know, at the time, you don't think about it as being something that you're in an intimate relationship with. But it turns out, years later, that you discover that actually you were.
I could not agree more. In fact, I think my interest in forest history as a line of research grew out of my intimate relationships with forests and my deep love for those forests, which was all nurtured during those experiences. I worry sometimes that younger generations are not going to have the same wealth that you and I experienced growing up with all of that kind of right down the road from us.
Yeah, one thing that's changed now, I think, that was definitely a thing back in our day is that I honestly, now looking back on it, being a parent myself, can imagine my parents say, oh, hey, it's Friday afternoon. Are you going up in the woods? Whew, thank goodness. We were not a quiet bunch. So anyway, to kind of shift gears here, I read somewhere recently that we learn from history that we're not very good at learning from history. And boy, that rang a bell, because you can apply that to so many things. But do you agree with that? And what are the lessons regarding our cohabitation with forests?
Yes, unfortunately, I do agree that that is a problem. And one of the things that we would do well to learn better, I think, from our history is just how important forests are to our well-being, and how on a lot of different levels, and how when we have not honored their well-being, we have done so at great peril to our own well-being. And the historical record is clear on this. The Appalachian region, of course, including eastern Kentucky, is so wonderfully rich in forests. They are a global wonder, the native forests of the Appalachian region. And those forests have been a source of, I think the word wealth is the right one to use, for the region throughout human habitation, which is, you know, 10, 12,000 years. And it's only been in the last couple of centuries that that has changed, and that we've impoverished our forests so much that that impoverishment contributes to our own impoverishment as human beings who live in the region, unfortunately.
In the introduction, I mentioned that half of Kentucky is covered by forests. We have lopped the tops off hundreds of mountains out in those forests, many of them quite remote and inaccessible areas, wilderness, if you will. We don't talk much about the consequences of that. Is that something that you think about often?
That's certainly one thing that I do think about, yes. And I also think about other ways that we have undercut the forest's ability to thrive and to support our thriving. Mountaintop removal is certainly an extreme example. And what gets lost in the thinking about that kind of intervention in the Appalachian landscape too often is the immense superpowers of the native Appalachian forests. They are wonderful citizens. The scholar Robin Wall Kimmerer, whose work might be familiar to some of your some of your listeners, talks about, in her part of the world, Maple Nation, the way the maple trees are such important citizens further north. And they're important citizens here as well, of course. But I think that we have a lot of equivalents to Maple Nation. We have so many species who are wonderful citizens. And I like that concept because it underscores the ways, the active contributions that trees and forests make to our well-being. And we could list so many, but among them are clean water, clean air, immense productivity from the Appalachian Forest, you know, my snacking ground growing up, for instance. Mm-hmm. And I didn't grow up in a hunting family, but a lot of people have helped support their families either all or in part through various forest-based livelihoods. And that is something I think we would be keeping in mind. Those are tend to be more sustainable livelihoods than some of the other ways that we have been making livings from the Appalachian region. And also, they're very good at flood control and drought control. They hold soils. They create soil fertility. There are just so many benefits from the forests. And we too often, I fear, think of them as passive and disposable, when in fact, they are very actively creating better worlds for us at every moment. And it would benefit us if we were to honor that a little bit more. In mountaintop removal sites, I'm sure many of your listeners know that Green Forest Work, for instance, has been doing wonderful work replanting native forests on mm-hmm. those. And the results are astonishing. The water is cleaner. The various organisms that make for healthy soils and for thriving biodiversity, those come back. I kind of think of the forest as superheroes. And so I think we would do well to encourage our superheroes rather than mow them down, as through U.S. history has happened too often.
Well, speaking of that, the current administration is rescinding protections against logging. And on nearly a third of national forest lands, the administration is proposing dropping the roadless rule. That's a 2001 rule that prohibits road construction and reconstruction, as well as timber harvesting on 58 million acres of U.S. Forest Service land. The rule has effectively protected them as remote wilderness areas. And according to Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, the idea is to open up more of the national forest to extract natural resources for domestic manufacturing. As one who studies forest sustainability, how do these actions strike you?
Well, I wish I thought they were wise. I do understand the impetus to harvest from our forests, but we've harvested a lot from our forests over our history. And so the question of sustainability is a really important one. And we're very lucky in Kentucky to have as much forested land as we do, but we don't have so much that we can be very cavalier mm-hmm. about the uses of these lands. And in terms of some of the bad news of recent history in Kentucky, such as the horrific flooding that has hit eastern Kentucky in the last few years and has caused so much human suffering. And then right now there's drought happening in a lot of areas. In terms of those kinds of negative impacts that we're seeing on the landscape and in human communities, this is not the wisest course. The wisest course would involve more protections, especially for our old growth forests, many of which are in those more distant areas. And it's important to help people have access to the forest so that they can grow to love them the way you and I experienced growing up. But it's also really important to balance that access with what the forest can sustain. And there's a long history of unsustainable forest harvesting in the Appalachians. And it has often been framed as if it were sustainable, when in fact it was not. And that became very clear very quickly.
Are people who know the ways of the forest, having spent lifetimes of living in them or very near them, are they being heard when they object to these kinds of actions, the clear cutting, for example?
Well, unfortunately, not to the degree that would benefit all of us. There is a part of what I study is the long Appalachian tradition of forest advocacy and forest defense, because so many Appalachian people have, as you say, deep experience of the forest, and they understand what forests need to thrive. I've done some research in Western North Carolina where bear hunters, for instance, were part of leading the charge to protect sections of the Nantahala and Pisgah, which are the North Carolina counterpart to the Daniel Boone. Also in West Virginia, similar things on the Monongahela. And then here in Kentucky, recently in the Jellicoe area, for instance, people have advocated against some of the harvest plans that are being implemented on the ground there. And their reasons are excellent. I saw a news story that mentioned the local concerns about landslides, for instance, and water quality. Those are both very well-founded concerns. And those steep areas, especially when you're clear-cutting in the mountains, there are all kinds of negative consequences to that because it increases the likelihood of landslides, increases the likelihood of drought and flood, increases the likelihood of soil depletion and also wildlife depletion. A lot of people who are anglers or who they're used to being out and they understand the needs of wildlife. And they understand that silted streams are bad for anglers as well as for the fish that they are looking to harvest. And that's important from a sustenance point of view and also from a cultural and recreational and community point of view, because angling is fun because you get to eat the fish. It's also fun because you're out there either alone or with your friends in a beautiful place. And
yeah. Well, if you spend most of your time in a city and you have little contact with forests, why should you care what happens to them?
That's almost a funny question to me, Tom, because, well, we all need clean air. We all need clean water. We all rely on healthy soils and fertile soils. We all live downstream. If you live in a city anywhere between the Atlantic and the Mississippi, then you are downstream from the Appalachian forests. And the Appalachian forests are going to look after you if they are well tended, or you will suffer consequences of their not looking after you, as happened. It's very clear in the deforestation area between 1880 and 1920, where, for instance, in the 1907 flood, Louisville was underwater, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh. I mean, everyone's downstream. So that would be one reason, but also just because you're in the city doesn't mean you can't ever go to enjoy a forest. But from just a very pragmatic standpoint, if you're downstream, then these negative effects of deforestation and forest ill health are coming for you eventually, too.
It's funny how this keeps being triggered, but I am reminded of the Wendell Berry paraphrasing of the Golden Rule, which is do unto those downstream as you would have those upstream do unto you. And
I love that, too.
Spot on. Well, Kathy, what are your greatest concerns about the state of our forests today?
There are a number of diseases of various keystone species, for instance. That's a real concern. And unfortunately, our worry is that, well, the scientists who study this are predicting that as our climate changes, these disease vectors and disease organisms will take more of a toll. I think that my main concern is just that we continue, if we return to the point that you were making earlier about how we've not learned from our history, if we continue to take these forests for granted, we do so at risk of undermining our own well-being. And unsustainable practices in the past have essentially been a form of forest mining, which means forests are only sustainable insofar as they can recover from the harvest practices that we use. And sustainable forest harvest is wonderful. As some of the Jellicoe advocates have said, I'm not against logging. And the Western North Carolina people and the Monongahela people, they have all said it's not that logging is something we object to. It's just that there are right ways and wrong ways to do it, as one of the Jellicoe advocates put it. There are sustainable ways and not sustainable ways to do it. And unfortunately, we have a history in the last couple hundred years of opting for unsustainable ways more often than sustainable ways. And I worry that those patterns may continue.
Do we opt for that approach because it seems in the short term to be more economical, short term.
I think that is a great point, Tom. I fear that is why. And it's only in the short term that that would be true. That in the great forest harvests between 1880 and 1920, for instance, current estimates, and we'll never know the full toll of all that happened, but certainly the flooding that transpired in the wake of those harvests downstream in all those cities across decades, measured in the billions of dollars. Soil fertility loss also measured in the billions of dollars. Productivity of our rivers and streams probably also measured in the billions of dollars, because all that soil's got to go somewhere. So it goes downstream and it silts up otherwise productive streams for wildlife. So I think that that myopia, I guess, about costs and benefits is, for me, the root of the worry. If we fully understood the real costs, we would be more careful about our decision making, and we would also be a lot more honoring of the forest citizens that do so much on our behalf.
Well, I'd like to urge everybody to just take the time to go out there and maybe perch yourself on a rock outcropping somewhere that looks out over a forest and breathe in the pine and listen to the sounds, and everything that we were just talking to you about is going to make a lot of sense.
Exactly. And there's also research on that now about how good that is for us.
Forest bathing.
Forest bathing is a whole, that's another thing that the Appalachian region could be globally known for, mm-hmm. because our forests are so incredibly rich. And so forest bathing is something we could develop as a signature, I don't want to quite call it industry, but like a signature health offering. And that's done in collaboration with our forests rather than in a less respectful relationship with our forests. So, but we know that that's really good for our blood pressure, like so many things that are, that's good for lots of things that plague us these days. So yes, by all means, please go out and enjoy that air. It will help your health as well as your well-being.
Okay, I'm going to stick a bookmark in this conversation right here, and hopefully you'll come back sometime soon. We'll continue the conversation.
That sounds good. In the meantime, enjoy the forest.
Dr. Catherine Newfont, Associate Professor of History at the University of Kentucky. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. There's a drive to live at the heart of things. Got to sink a pipe into that spring. Let it water.
A few minutes ago, I mentioned novelist, poet, essayist, and environmental activist, cultural critic, and farmer Wendell Berry. Another quote attributed to him goes like this: "We've lived our lives by the assumption that what was good for us would be good for the world. We've been wrong. We must change our lives so that it will be possible to live by the contrary assumption that what's good for the world will be good for us. And that requires that we make the effort to know the world and learn what's good for it." Environmental philosophy is concerned with the natural environment and how we humans fit into it. It raises some crucial questions about human-environmental relations, and those questions have probably never been more urgent than they are today as we experience the calling cards of climate change, including more frequent, more intense rainstorms and flooding, wildfires, groundwater depletion, and sea level rise. It's a lot to take in. Here for a conversation about this is Max Gendreau, Marlene and David Grissom Associate Professor of Philosophy and Environmental Studies at Center College in Danville. Max, thanks for stopping by.
My pleasure.
So first, if you would, just tell us about your field and how you connect philosophy and environment.
We think of philosophy sort of historically, if we go back to the ancient Greeks, right, there's this idea that philosophy begins in wonder. And in some sense, it seems like it's pretty basic then, that one of the things that philosophy is concerned with is the natural environment, because, you know, in some sense, what could be more wondrous or what could be more sort of awe-inspiring? As a sort of discipline, it's something that's really arisen as an, you know, significant field of academic study over the past century or so, in part because The human-nature relationship has become complicated, perhaps, or at least more complex, we might think, than it might have been in a more agrarian sort of society. So part of what we think about in environmental philosophy is really how our kinds of conceptual understandings of ourselves and our conceptual understandings of the world more broadly map onto both our kind of experience of the natural world and our experience of the environment, but also sort of how we understand ourselves in that relationship. Are we part of the natural world? Are we distinct from the natural world? And all of these kinds of questions, I think, are sort of foundational and really fundamental to environmental philosophy, but, you know, more broadly to just the human experience.
Well, what do you consider to be the most important philosophical challenges that are presented to us by climate change?
Gosh, in some ways, all of them, right? So there are a lot of different philosophers who are thinking about climate change, and there are all sorts of questions that arise, questions of justice. So how do we think about what we owe to each other? Or what societies owe to their citizens, or what governments of different societies owe to other governments in the context of climate change. There are philosophical questions about responsibility. You know, do we think about holding polluters accountable for decisions that they've made? Do we think about holding nations accountable? You know, what is my individual obligation, right? Do I have a moral obligation to buy a hybrid or to buy an EV? And I think all of these are really foundational. Where I kind of have entered into this discussion, at least in my own thinking, has been really focused on questions of how we think about ourselves. So, of course, there are these really high-level, big questions about, you know, the sort of structure of society and how we as a group think about things. And obviously, those are really important. But I think one of the sort of central things that we also have to think about is the sort of impact of a shifting climate and the impact of the climate crisis on me, right? Which isn't just to say that it's about me or that it's really sort of focusing on the individual, but the fact that this isn't just going to affect us in this really abstract way, right? It's going to affect us in these really direct ways.
Well, that term, climate change, it has a word in the phrase that might trigger some people. We tend to resist change. We like things to stay consistent. Do you think that the resistance to accepting that our climate is rapidly changing can be traced to our natural aversion to change, especially on such a scale as this?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's a lot to unpack there, right? And thinking about both climate and change is in some ways both being kind of triggering words, right? At least in the sort of current political landscape is maybe helpful. But I think if we think about change itself, one of the things that I like to remind myself of is that human beings have managed to adapt to live in wildly, wildly different kinds of conditions, which gives me a little bit of confidence that we're a little bit more changeable than maybe we necessarily think that we are. But I think that you're right. Change is terrifying, right? It's really scary. And one of the things that I think we need to be thinking about when we talk about climate change is the actual sort of lived experience of climate change as distinct from this abstract idea that the sea levels are rising, because that's sort of hard for me to get my head around, even if I'm somebody who lives in a coastal area. Whereas change is also just a central part of what it means to be a human being, right? We can't step in the same river twice if we go back to the ancients. So I think you're right, right? But I also sort of think of this as an opportunity for us to sort of think about how to guide change or how to reflect on change or how to be sort of clear about change with ourselves.
So it's kind of a way to wrestle change to the ground and understand it and mm-hmm. kind of own it.
Mm-hmm.
And Megs, I know you're working on a book that's based on the notion that we all want to live well, allowing for all sorts of variations on what exactly living well means. And that this widely shared human desire is being consistently undermined by changing conditions, such as ongoing intertwined ecological crises, climate change. How can we shape an approach that we can rely on for guidance?
So rely on is maybe a little strong, but I have some thoughts. So when I think about what it means to be a human being, right, we have a tendency, I think, to be like, human beings are like this, right? We have this set of attributes. Or we have these kinds of tendencies. And fundamentally, a human life is composed of really basic stuff of getting up in the morning and making coffee and saying hello to your spouse or walking your dog or watering your garden, all of these kinds of things. And that's what I think about when I think about climate change. And that's what I think about when I think about living well. And not to say that the really abstract concerns, if we're thinking about something like significant loss of species, or we're thinking about something like radically transformed systems of precipitation, right? Obviously, those are really central to any conversation about climate. But from my perspective, one of the things that I think would be the most helpful, and maybe this is about my own sort of personal psychology to some degree, is to take away the sort of huge, overwhelming idea of climate change and focus on the things that actually make our lives good for us, the things that are actually central to our identities and the things that we're thinking about living a good life, we're living well. Most of that isn't about these huge things. It's about having relationships that matter, or having hobbies even, really sort of basic components, like the nuts and bolts of everyday life.
Well, I know that your book is inspired by a concern, a fear, maybe, that we're having great difficulty with being honest with ourselves and each other about what this means. Take us down that path for a moment.
Certainly. So I'm going to go really high level just for a moment here and talk about the kind of multinational approaches and some of the kind of background for thinking about how we address climate change. So there are a few big pillars of climate discussions. One of them is mitigation, which is essentially acting in ways that prevent climate change from happening, right? So this involves things like reducing greenhouse gas emissions, okay? And then the next part is adaptation, which is learning how to live in the context of a radically changing world. And in the more recent past, and by recent, I mean sort of within the last decade or so, this becomes a big focus of the Paris agreements, is this idea of loss and damage. So we mitigate to try to prevent the impacts of the changing climate. We adapt to the changing climate. But there's at least an understanding amongst a lot of folks now that adaptation will not be able to address everything, right? There are certain things that we can't adapt away from, mm-hmm. right? So there's only so many seawalls you can build. There are only so many different ways that we can maybe genetically modify organisms in order to continue growing the same kinds of crops that we've been growing in an area. And I've thought a lot about loss and damage for a few years now. And a lot of what I think about when I think about loss and damage is the challenge of confronting loss and how profound that is for people, but also the necessity. And part of this is just to say we can think about loss and damage in terms of, you know, sort of catastrophic worry, right? We can be kind of doomers about this. Or we can say, this is what's at stake. This is what's at stake for us. This is what's at stake for me. And maybe you and I share an interest in propagating a rare sort of rose, right? And that's at risk if we're thinking about sort of radically changing climate patterns. So maybe we, one, can be honest about the fact that both this is important to us and, right, that it's something that's potentially under threat. And because we can be honest with ourselves, maybe we can find different pathways for ensuring that at least we're losing less than we might otherwise. Even if full adaptation isn't a possibility, even if sort of completely addressing these sorts of challenges isn't necessarily an option forward for us, minimally, if we can talk about what it means for you and me to be able to continue this thing that's really central to us, right, that's important to our identities, or again, that's just like a huge part of everyday life, right, the thing you do when you get up in the morning, then we can both understand what's at stake, but we can also take measures, whatever those measures end up looking like, to ensure that this thing that we really value can be maintained or minimally can be preserved as something that we care about, even if what it looks like to engage in this practice is really different.
I know this might be a little bit off the wall, but I think it's something that you've given a lot of thought to, so I'll throw it out there. And that is about love. How does love play a role in how we comprehend and cope with climate change.
Yeah. So it feels a little silly sometimes to say this out loud because I'm not a terribly sentimental person in a lot of respects, but I think that love is at the heart of all of it. I mean, when I think about what it means for me to be a human being, it's about the things that I care about. It's about my relationships. It's about the folks who I love, the things that I love, and the things that give my life the kind of significance or maybe focus that I want that life to have. So there are a couple of ways of thinking about the role of love here, right? One of them is that for me, thinking about preserving what we have, whether that is, you know, cultivating a really fancy rose or ensuring that future generations will be able to play outside during the summer, right? That is an act of love. It's an act of love for the things that are important to me, and it's an act of love for other persons. But I also think that love and caring for things has the capacity to light up the world for us in ways that are really important. It can create pathways toward not just thinking of ourselves as worthy of value, but thinking of others as worthy of being valued. It lights up the world, it generates pathways, and in some ways it moves us forward. I mean, I think love and hope and anything that looks vaguely like optimism are deeply entwined with each other. So for me, part of what I think about when I think about climate change is I think about what it means to continue loving the things and the people and the experiences and the parts of the world that I love into the future. And that doesn't mean stasis. To love something ideally isn't to never want it to change. It's to want it to flourish. And obviously we can say, I want the earth to flourish, but that's a lot to take on for me, for you, for anybody. And so for most of us, I think acts of love are about ensuring that these everyday, again, back to the kind of, you know, the nuts and bolts of a human life, right? The everyday stuff can flourish into the future.
It's Megs Gendreau, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Environmental Studies and Chair of Environmental Studies at Centre College in Danville. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Our thanks to Bruce Coburn for the song To Keep the World We Know. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our archive, our contributors and their interviews, and you can sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.